Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. While the U.S. economy continues white hot, socialism is on the rise. Our president isn't impressed.
Everywhere it's been implemented, it's produced poverty, misery, repression, and despair. You take a look, no matter where. America will never be a socialist country.
Where's the enticement? Why, it's the Green New Deal. We'll hear from Lan He Chen.
The last thing it means is that the government is going to be deciding what kind of health care you get. These are the same people that run the DMV, mind you.
The situation in Venezuela, front page just a few days ago, is now on the back pages if you see any coverage at all. Maybe that's because the left may be losing?
I think Maduro's a weak personality, and I think there's at least a chance that he will waver, the military will push him out, and he can go off and live happily ever after on a hacienda outside of Havana.
And graphically, the abortionists are staging a counteroffensive.
It is infanticide what's being promoted in states like Virginia and New York. I mean, it's just the most disgusting thing in the world that these organizations and these members of the various legislative bodies think that it's okay to abort a baby at 40 weeks.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and let me invite you to join me now by video. Socialism is back, although it reared its head nationally in the 2016 presidential election in the person of Bernie Sanders. Socialism has been steadily growing around the U.S. for years. Even though the economy has been booming almost continuously since President Trump took office, the Democratic Party is decidedly pro-socialist. On Capitol Hill, it's hard to find a Democrat who will boldly denounce it, even its leaders. In California, said to be the fifth largest economy in the world, incoming Governor Newsom is busy focusing on a socialist dream, a budget surplus. My colleague Larry Elder, himself a Californian, follows this trend closely.
President Trump said America will never be a socialist country.
And last month, the United States recognized the legitimate government of Venezuela and condemned the socialist brutality of the Maduro regime. Everywhere it's been implemented, it's produced poverty, misery, repression, and despair. You take a look, no matter where. Yet there are those trying to implement socialism right here in the United States. So I again say to you, and I say it for the world to hear, America will never be a socialist country. Never. Never.
Now, keep in mind that Democrats, according to polls, have a more positive view of socialism than they do of capitalism. Bernie Sanders is a self-described socialist. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a self-described Democrat socialist. You've got socialists blatantly talking about their party. Now, we've had UCLA economist Leo Hanian on the show a number of times. He wrote an article back in December called, "After Spending $5.4 billion, California's bullet train is still going nowhere." Now, the new governor of California, Gavin Newsom, announced he is pulling the plug on the bullet train. Quote, "Let's be real. The current project as planned would cost too much and respectfully take too long. There's been too little oversight and not enough transparency." Close quote. He said $5.4 billion later. Better late than never. Some signs of intelligent life in California from a hard lefty who ran, saying he wanted to complete the bullet train, but then got elected, saw the numbers, and said, Or did he already know that, but felt that he would not get elected if he said, "I wanted to kill the bullet train"? Either way, it's now dead.
The latest national socialist bonfire came to us from the darling of the congressional newcomers, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Called the Green New Deal, it has stoked up all the incoming lefties. Lan He Chen, a political strategist and Salem editorial board member, was on with my colleague Sebastian Gorka.
What is the Green New Deal, Professor Chen?
Well, I take it at its word. I take the face of the document that was posted I guess, late last week that was actually a resolution that was proposed in the U.S. House, in the U.S. Senate, that talks about a variety of different policies. Now, they may want to walk it back, but clearly it is an effort not just to address climate change, and that's sort of the cover for all of this. And, Sebastian, I think the description of it as a watermelon is very apropos, because deep within the bowels of the Green New Deal is a unmistakable move toward socialism. It is an unmistakable move toward greater government influence, not just over carbon emissions. And yes, it's true, they want to get rid of all gas-burning vehicles. It's also true that they're interested in instituting health care for everyone via a government-run system. It's also true that they're interested in minimum wage guarantees. It's also true that they're interested in universal paid leave that's paid for by taxpayers. So it's not just climate policy they're worried about. They're worried about a whole spectrum of things. And if you look at the text of the Green New Deal, you will see just how expansive and broad it really is.
Do we have to take it seriously? As a person who teaches public policy, is this just a crackpot idea that will flame out when Americans understand the strictures upon their freedom that it entails? Or is this really an attempt to introduce socialism by stealth? Do we take this seriously or not?
I take it seriously because there are people out there who take it seriously. There are people in the Democratic Party. And by the way, Sebastian, these are not, you know, just a few fringe members of the Democratic Party. I am talking about essentially all of the declared candidates for president of the United States in the Democratic Party have said they support this. So this is not a crackpot scheme. This is actually something that supposedly serious people have endorsed. And so we do have to take it seriously. But the reality is, once Americans realize, for example, let's just take Medicare for All as a small microcosm of this discussion. Medicare for All, you know, free health care, sounds great until you realize it means a few things. First of all, it means that the coverage you currently have will no longer exist.
Right.
The second thing it means is that taxes are going to have to go up substantially higher. I'm not talking about, you know, 10% higher. I'm talking about 80, 90, 100% higher. And then the last thing it means is that the government is going to be deciding what kind of health care you get.
Yes.
These are the same people that run the DMV, mind you. These are the people who are going to be determining whether you need that medical procedure. And so this is what I mean. I think once Americans are a remarkably smart and attuned people, and when they realize what this means, they're going to go bonkers. But if we don't take it seriously, some of this stuff is going to kind of float underneath the radar and catch us by surprise.
Professor Chen, and the last question in this segment, perhaps. Do these individuals, AOC included, Rashida Tlaib, Kamala Harris, in your following of the trends inside the left of the Democrat Party writ large, Have they taken it over, or is the old guard still resisting? Do you expect some kind of peace treaty, or is the radical, the individuals who call themselves socialists, they had 40 candidates in the midterms who actually call themselves socialists, is this the new DNC, or is there still that battle to be fought for the soul of the Democrat Party?
I think a battle is coming. But I do think it's a battle that this wing, this far left progressive wing of the Democratic Party, is ultimately going to win. All of these Democrats are united in their burning desire to defeat Donald Trump in 2020. And that is the one thing that brings them all together. But indeed, that is also their very downfall.
Yes.
Because they don't realize that they are pushing these crazy far left policies. And by the way, I think you'll agree with me. President Trump had it exactly right in his State of the Union when he talked about this as a fight between socialism and our system of free enterprise,
right,
of capitalism and of freedom. And that's absolutely the right way to look at it. The left will overreach. They've done it over and over again. And this is another example of that overreach.
Go to townhallreview.com for the rest of that discussion. While you're there, take a moment to sign up for our podcast. This Green New Deal has garnered support from top Democrats. It's pretty remarkable how radical the proposal is. One of my frequent guests, Senator Tom Cotton, weighed in on my program. Do you believe your colleagues knew what they were endorsing when they endorsed her crazy get rid of the cows and the airplanes white paper?
Sure. I mean, Hugh, it's pretty remarkable that when these Democrats put out the Green New Deal last week, that you had many Democrats running for president leap onto a proposal that was going to confiscate every privately owned vehicle in America within a decade and ban air travel so we could all drive or ride around on high-speed light rail, supposedly powered by unicorn tears.
Don't forget the cow. The cows, they're all gone.
Well, we can all become vegan since cows are gone as well, since cow flatulence is a mortal threat to the world. Look, this is a classic example of a gaffe being when you say what you really mean. I understand the Democrats that proposed this immediately tried to retract that white paper that went along with their resolution, and too many people in the media have been complicit in the Stalin-like or 1984 technique of disappearing it, sending it down the memory hole. But this is where their heart lies. They believe that Americans driving around in trucks on farms or commuting from the suburbs where they can have a decent home into the city to get to work are a fundamental threat to the world. And they have to have the power and the control of those Americans' lives to implement their radical vision for humanity.
Let me then switch to another radical vision, BDS, Boycott, Divest, Sanction Israel. Marco Rubio introduced a anti-BDS resolution. I'm sure you voted for it. But I think it's beginning to dawn on people this isn't just a nutty idea of the left. It's spreading abroad.
Yeah, Hugh, it has been spreading around the world, unfortunately. The Senate passed that with a pretty healthy vote. But unfortunately, it really divided the Democratic caucus. This is what you see over the last 25 to 30 years, regrettably, since the Oslo Accords. Support for Israel has steadily increased among Republicans and independents, yet it's stagnated or even declined among Democrats. This is not just an issue of radical liberals in the Congress, but this is where a lot of the heart of the Democratic Party lies. And frankly, whether it's here in the United States or if you look abroad, there's a connection between these two issues we're discussing. Throughout history, if you look hard enough at an anti-capitalist and what they say, you often find an anti-Semite.
So, Senator Cotton, between the Green New Deal, between BDS and refusal to support anti-BDS legislation, has the Democratic Party gone off the cliff?
So I think, Hugh, that over the last two weeks or so, what we've seen is not so much the Democratic Party going over the cliff, but the Democratic Party showing its true colors, that they truly do want the power to radically remake every American's lives.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
I think Maduro's a weak personality, and I think there's at least a chance the military will push him out and he can go off and live happily ever after on a hacienda outside of Havana.
Venezuela's future on the line when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. That's publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. The agony of the once prosperous Venezuelan people will not go away soon. There is, however, a hopeful tone in the diplomatic reports we've heard. No, Venezuelan strongman Nicolas Maduro has not yet stepped down, and he appears to retain support from his military leadership. But acting head of state opposition leader Juan Guaido, now nearly 3 weeks into this new role, is still there and ready to assume his legitimate role. I spoke with retired Admiral James Stavridis, former head of Southern Command and of NATO, on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Marco Rubio specifically tweeted this: future of democracy in Venezuela is largely in the hands of six men, General Vladimir Padrino, Admiral Remigio Ceballos, Major General Jesus Rafael Suarez Chorio, Admiral Giuseppe Alessandro Cimadavilla, Major General Edgar Valentin Cruz Arteaga, and Major General Antonio Benavides Torres. First question, do you know any of those guys?
I know the second admiral you mentioned, and I think that these are serious men who are calculating closely which way the wind is blowing. I am cautiously optimistic that this one is going to land diplomatically. And I think the Trump administration, which has had some hits and had some misses, as we were just talking about a moment ago, is going at this one with great deal of innovation and using all the tools, economic, diplomatic, political, social networks, highly effectively. And I think that we can land this thing. I'd say 3 in 4 chance. The military rolls on Maduro. Maduro's out of there.
Now, when you specifically address senior officers by name, and then Senator Rubio goes on to say, amnesty is yours. You're speaking for Juan Guaido there, but they did, the National Assembly did offer them amnesty.
Yes.
I actually don't know that there's a precedent for this. We tried this, I think, in Chile, and it went very, very badly wrong under Nixon. Have we tried this successfully before?
You can make the argument that this is how we got Idi Amin out of his nation back in the 80s. But in recent diplomatic history, it has not. It's often proposed. There were discussions about this with Saddam Hussein. Most recently, in my experience, is the Supreme Allied Commander in NATO, Hugh, in Libya. As we were launching that campaign, we tried everything we could to convince Muammar Gaddafi to simply leave, and offered him a number of different, really attractive next places he could go. Typically, these repressionist dictators hold on longer than they should, and someone like Gaddafi ends up murdered by his own people. I think Maduro's a weak personality, and I think there's at least a chance that he will waver, the military will push him out, and he can go off and live happily ever after on a hacienda outside of Havana.
Yeah, baby Doc Duvalier took the Idi Amin option as well.
Yes, and that's so a good example.
It does happen, but then I go back to the military, and what Senator Rubio was saying is you can be part of the rebuild because you have not opened fire on the civilians. That's the implication, is that you have not crossed a line yet. Do you think that's actually possible for them to immediately go in with President-designate Guaido and begin to function as a real military functions, for example, in this country in support of the civilian government?
I think so. And I'll give you an example of where we didn't play this one particularly well was in Iraq. After we defeated the Iraqi armed forces in the invasion in 2003-2004, rather than saying to them, now is your chance to become a professional military, we simply decapitated them. We fired them all. We put a lot of the senior ones in jail. And that army, that Iraqi army, is what built the resistance, which we had to fight. And you can drop a plumb line from that to the Islamic State. So I think that we would be well served to give this military the opportunity and tell them this is your chance.
It seemed that after the Planned Parenthood body parts scandals, coupled with the horrible discoveries at Kermit Gosnell's abortion mill in Philadelphia, the abortion rights movement was decreasing in influence, or at least we had hoped. In January, the state of New York enacted one of the most liberal laws in the country, legalizing abortion up to the point of birth. My colleague Mike Gallagher spoke with a Texas legislator, Tan Parker, who's leading a charge against this new push.
Look at the issue of life, the sanctity of life. Have we ever heard a more pro-life president in our lifetime? Representative Tan Parker is a perfect example of that kind of warrior out of the great state of Texas. He's currently in his sixth term. He is beloved. Can we take a breath and understand that we've never seen a president fight for border security the way this guy has?
The reality is here in Texas, we understand the situation with the border better than anybody. The porous border causes all kinds of issues. We have to secure our border, and we're proud here in Texas of what President Trump is doing and the fact that he's standing so firm.
And I'm so proud of the focus on life. Everywhere I go, I've said this for years, whenever I give a talk somewhere or I talk to meet one-on-one with people and I talk about the need to have leadership that defends the unborn, that defends the sanctity of life, that defends the elderly, that defends the disabled. I mean, we've got a president who does so, and yet we've watched a shocking, shocking admission, transparency from the Democrats. This law in New York, what they tried to do in Virginia that got Ralph Northam in all the trouble he's in, Vermont, Rhode Island, we're seeing this steady march towards Democrats who want zero restrictions on abortion, which, as you know, Representative Parker, includes late-term abortion. It's pretty ghastly And yet there are Republicans who are trying to fight the good fight on this issue.
Mike, it's just barbaric, frankly. It is infanticide what's being promoted in states like Virginia and New York. I mean, it's just the most disgusting thing in the world that these organizations and these members of the various legislative bodies think that it's okay to abort a baby at 40 weeks. It's just absolutely unbelievable. Terrific. And so I'm proud of Texas. I'm proud of the fact that Texas is standing up. It's important for us as Republicans to be strong and to be united, and that we protect life from conception to natural death, that we take care of the most vulnerable in our society. And so that's why I'm very honored to be a part of the leadership team working to make certain that we pass the heartbeat bill here in Texas.
It's no, it's House Bill 1500, as you said, known as the Texas Heartbeat Bill. Let's talk about what it does, Representative Parker. Spell it out for the nation.
You know what, Mike? It's very, very simple. If a heartbeat can be detected, the baby will be protected. It's just that simple. You know, the reality is that the heartbeat is a universal symbol for life. And so if there is a heartbeat, that unborn precious child will be protected if we pass this legislation.
It's and it's happening around the country. A fetal heartbeat bill was also filed in Florida's Senate. Mississippi has a heartbeat bill working its way through committee. Similar efforts are underway in Kentucky, Ohio, South Carolina, Tennessee. Now, what you're up against are activist judges, which is, of course, again, why elections have consequences. Iowa passed a heartbeat law last year, but a state judge declared it unconstitutional and struck it down last month. Isn't it fascinating that critics of this law say that a heartbeat can be detected before a woman realizes she's pregnant, as if somehow that obfuscates the reality that this is a living human being in the womb?
If we as conservative Republicans don't stand together, if we don't stand up, if we don't have a bold agenda that shows the differences between Republicans and Democrats, we won't be successful.
Coming up.
They place the rope in a noose around his neck, and then they run away.
Was this a near lynching or a clever hoax? When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, politicians find themselves on the hot seat for college indiscretions.
One thing we cannot do is have one standard of forgiveness for friends and another whole standard of lack of forgiveness for our foes.
Senator Ben Sasse speaks out against late-term abortions.
The American people have been repulsed by this.
And he calls on the U.S. Senate to act.
Civilized people don't do that.
To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The Jussie Smollett attempting lynching case hit the media like gangbusters, making Smollett a media star, if not an acting sensation. Almost overnight, the incident fell into doubt, with hazy details and contradicting stories and a lack of victim cooperation. My colleague Dennis Prager recently spoke with National Review's critic at large, Kyle Smith, about the case.
Why don't you, before anything, just give us a very brief review of what he claims happened?
Well, it's odd. He's told the story several different ways. Well, not several different ways, but he sort of added details to the story as it has gone on. And as far as I can tell, what he's saying is he's buying a Subway sandwich at 2 o'clock in the morning. Two guys recognize him, jump him, start beating him up, although not badly enough for him to suffer any serious injuries. They say some hateful things to him. And they also have a liquid and a rope with them. They place the rope in a noose around his neck, and then they run away. Jussie, the whole time, is talking to his manager on the phone, and he also still has the sandwich with him. He doesn't call the police on that phone when the two guys run away. He doesn't say, oh, these two guys just jumped me, and they went that away. He goes to an apartment building. He walks right by security. He goes to, I guess, his manager's apartment, tells him about it, and this friend or manager calls the police 40 minutes later, by which time, of course, the guys have disappeared. All this takes place on a really, really cold night in Chicago,
And the whole time, Jesse still has this rope around his neck for upwards of 40 minutes. And when the police ask to see his phone to confirm that he was talking to his manager, he refuses to do that. And I guess he hasn't even turned over his phone records now. 2 weeks have gone by. And Jesse said at a concert that he fought back against these two guys. So he retained his cell phone and his sandwich and fought back. He didn't call the police for 40 minutes. And when he did talk to the police, he neglected to mention what seems like a pretty important detail, which is the two guys yelled, "This is MAGA country. This is Make America Great Again country," as they ran away. He didn't mention that in his first interview to the police. It turned up in a TMZ story. In a subsequent interview, Jesse then said, "Oh, yeah, they also said this is MAGA country, by the way." To me, this is an odd story with a lot of unexplained questions.
Do we know where he was coming from?
I think he had just flown into Chicago. They do work on the show there. I think they shoot some of the show there. And he had, I guess, mentioned it on Instagram or something that he was flying in. So in theory, someone who was following him obsessively would have known that he had arrived there and maybe knew where he lived and maybe was could have been hanging out waiting for him.
Why are you suspicious?
The story just doesn't make sense to me. How do you beat off a couple of attackers while holding a sandwich and talking on the cell phone? I mean, if I'm going to beat somebody up, and he's talking on the cell phone, I would think I would pick the phone away from him and, smash the phone. If I was going to choke somebody with a rope, I wouldn't just leave it dangling around his neck. If I intended to really beat somebody up, I would, beat him up. I wouldn't just let him go. There's no motive for the guys running away. There's a 60-second gap between, he's sort of walking down the street and when he's got the rope around his neck. So at some point in that 60 seconds, the attack must have taken place.
By sheer coincidence, the only time the surveillance cameras did not operate.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we'll find footage that's damning either way. I don't know.
Okay, my third reason is, in addition to that, we have to believe it's about 20 below zero, 2 a.m., and two guys are walking around with a rope waiting for a black to lynch.
That is one of many strange details. I don't understand why these two random people happen to have a rope and some unknown liquid with them that was reported to be bleach, but maybe not. And if they're so determined to carry out this attack, why they confine themselves to just a few seconds and then ran away?
Why has he not, as of this moment, he has still not given his phone records?
So far, yeah, there's been no phone records, and certainly the phone was not turned over. They had a lot of detectives working on this, by the way, like a dozen or more detectives plus FBI are involved. And they said they'd found the retailer of the rope, so now they're looking at surveillance footage from, stores where rope is sold to see if they can find somebody buying the rope who might fit the description.
Have the police said anything, or that's not their place?
On the record, the police have only stated, we're taking this very seriously. Hate crimes are a very, very serious crime. We really want to find the perpetrators. We have no reason to believe he's not telling the truth, and we're going to investigate every lead, and so on and so on. So they're doing the right thing, as far as I can tell.
They have said we have no reason to believe he's not telling the truth? They've actually used those words?
Yeah. The chief spokesman or the head of the police Information Bureau said that about a week ago.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
The original New Deal was supposed to take us from mass unemployment to full employment. But the Green New Deal would take us from full employment to mass unemployment. So I call it the Green Great Depression.
Alex Epstein weighs in on the Green Great Depression when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. The amount of hot air that has been generated by the Green New Deal, pro and con, is still mounting. My friend and colleague Dennis Prager decided to go on air with an unrivaled expert in industrial economics, Alex Epstein, founder and the CEO of the Center for Industrial Progress.
I want to hear in your words, I can imagine, but I still want to hear your reaction to the Green New Deal.
Sure. Well, the original New Deal was supposed to take us from mass unemployment to full employment. But the Green New Deal would take us from full employment to mass unemployment. So I call it the Green Great Depression.
It's Orwellian that this will promote jobs. But go ahead. Why don't you amplify on your point?
Well, if you look at what has led to so much employment and much of the prosperity we experience today, and even prosperity that increased under the Obama administration, a huge portion of it is our energy leadership in the world, that we are a leading producer of many forms of energy, particularly oil and gas, and that cheap, plentiful, reliable coal, oil, and gas have made us more and more of an industrial superpower. In general, when you can produce cheap, plentiful, reliable energy, it gives you an amazing just productivity advantage, and it also is a huge security advantage. And so to take that and then to say we want to outlaw those three technologies, coal, oil, and gas, and then we also want to outlaw the only potential cheap, plentiful, reliable source of non-carbon electricity that we're aware of, which is nuclear, that is combining really the religion, the green religion, with the economics of socialism. And that is the worst thing imaginable. The socialism is bad enough on its own. But then when you combine socialism with anti-nuclear asceticism, you're in really big trouble.
I do these fireside chats for Prager University each week, and it's a lot of young people watch, so they also, they send in questions. So somebody asked me, a 17-year-old, what should I do with my professor or teacher, I don't remember what it was, who just stands up in class and speaks about the green energy and the dangers that the world is coming to an end. I said, just ask the professor, do you support nuclear energy? So that, to me, separates the people who are serious from the people who have a religion, just as you said.
Yeah, that is the easiest litmus test that there is that I know of, because if you think that CO2 levels are a crisis, but you care about human flourishing, you need to recognize that energy abundance is an essential of human flourishing. That's the core of what brought us from a life expectancy of 30 to a life expectancy of 80. So if you care about CO2 levels for human flourishing reasons, then you need to find the most likely substitute for fossil fuels on a global scale. And while nuclear can't substitute fully for fossil fuels, it's by far the second best option that we have right now, and could in the future be the first best option, and yet it is criminalized by the green movement. So my simple test is, are you aggressively supporting the decriminalization of nuclear? And the Green New Deal is focused on the full criminalization.
Do you even understand on the Green New Deal what this notion is of getting rid of airplanes? Was this a new thing in your experience?
There's at least an honesty, because when people talk about 100% renewable, they usually mean 100% solar and wind. But they at least recognize that there's no electric planes. And so they recognize that fossil fuels, particularly oil-based fuels, are necessary for air travel. So there's a certain amount of intellectual honesty in saying, yeah, we are going to not fly anymore. So we're going to reverse the Wright brothers. One thing that's going on here that's important, and that's basically true of anyone who's a socialist or a fascist, which are very close together, is they have no appreciation of the industrial achievements that freedom has made possible. So they're always trying to impose some scheme that they came up with. And we have a lot of precedents for this historically. The one that most scares me, because it seems most relevant, is Stalin's use of Lysenko's genetic theories in Soviet Russia, which led to mass starvation. And here we have, with green energy, this is a failed technology. There's no such thing as a green energy economy. There's no way to power an economy with fundamentally unreliable fuel sources. Just the technology isn't close to existing. And yet you have some cranks who are informing the powers that be, mostly for reasons of religious affiliation, green religious affiliation. And so they're really trying to impose this crazy crank theory on the entire economy.
When you plug in an electric car, isn't fossil fuel involved?
Yeah. The fundamental thing is when you have an unreliable fuel source like the sun and the wind, it by itself cannot support an energy system at all. And so then what you need is you need a reliable fuel source. But the problem is because the sun and the wind can go to almost zero at any given time, you need a 100% reliable energy system plus the unreliable energy system. So it ends up costing you much.
Well, let's be honest. The weakness, which proves your excellent point that green is a religion, not a science, is the opposition to the clean, reliable energy of nuclear power.
Exactly. So the religion in this case, the God is the God of unchanged nature. But it's the rest of nature can change. It's particularly the God of nature unimpacted by man. So it's a deeply anti-human view because they're all for change by every other species. But anything humans do to nature is considered bad, which this is why I call them human racists, because they're fundamentally against the human race.
Do you think this will awaken many Americans who are not religiously green to the dangers of green?
Well, I think that one thing that's necessary is to have a clear positive alternative, which I would like to see a lot more of from the right. And the one element of the positive alternative is to be really excited about energy freedom, including the decriminalization of nuclear, and to tell the story about how energy freedom, particularly in the last 10 years, has led to incredible prosperity and empowerment for Americans and really people around the world.
The full interview with Dr. Epstein is available at townhallreview.com and at our podcast. Sign up at townhallreview.com and get a daily dose of the best in conservative talk radio. And let me add a special invitation here. We're going to be doing more exclusive interviews in the days to come, stuff you'll only get as you subscribe to our podcast. I'm excited to extend an invitation to you. Join us or let me join you on your handheld device. Go to Town Hall Review. Coming up,
we believe life is the better choice.
Jim Daly, when we return with the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Focus on the Family may be one of the most widely known pro-family, pro-life radio programs in the world. In the early years, the mid-late 70s, they pioneered a produced-for-radio format and partnered with my syndicator, Salem Media, to grow rapidly. Now, 40 years later, Focus is so ably led by CEO Jim Daly, and he's a warrior. In the wake of the pro-abortion avalanche in recent weeks, I invited Jim on my program to hear about Focus's weighty response to this threat to unborn life. Am I right that abortion is going to return to the center of the political debate in 2020?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, again, the president has done a wonderful job putting this front stage through the State of the Union address. And then, of course, the Democrats passing legislation that is so overreaching that a very small number of Americans support. I saw one poll, only 13% of Americans supporting third trimester abortion. Good luck with that.
Would you explain to people just how radical the left has gone here?
Well, in the Virginia case, what they were proposing, thankfully it didn't pass, but the Virginia governor was supportive, and that is when a baby is born, and he's a pediatrician, when the baby is born, that if that baby is deemed unviable or if they have a severe handicap, that the mother and the doctor could discuss ending its life after it's born. That's infanticide. That's murder. And this is what we've come to. I think many philosophers 50 years ago said if we pass abortion, before 1973 when it was passed, philosophers were saying this will be the end game. We will begin to do baby selection after the baby is born because of defect or some other reason. Well, America, here we are. We've arrived.
What do people in the pro-life movement, and even many pro-reproductive rights people who aren't extremists, what do they do? Where do they rally? How are you putting out the word?
Well, I appreciate that. What we've done is we want people to go to focusonthefamily.com/pro-life, focusonthefamily.com/pro-life, to sign a pro-life declaration. We're going to deliver that to the Congress and the White House to hopefully say, here are millions of signatures of people who stand with life. And then secondly, we are doing on May 4th, it's a Saturday, the Saturday before Mother's Day, we've come up with, I think, a great idea. We're calling it Alive from New York, and we're going to do
in Times Square, a live 4D ultrasound of a third trimester baby, along with great speakers and music to celebrate life. And we want moms and dads and kids to come out to Times Square and be a part of it. Hopefully we can get 50,000 people out there to say we support life because we believe life is the better choice.
Alive from New York. I go to Times Square a lot, and there are usually a couple of thousand people milling around, but you can put 50,000 people in there very easily, Jim Daly.
Absolutely, and that's the statement I think we need to make. When we talk about the early church and what they did to fight infanticide and abortion, which they had back then, nothing new under the sun, right, Hugh?
The Moloch.
They stood for life, and they made a declaration. That's what we want to do on May 4th.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schumann and producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne the radio blogger Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.